Ready here? Ed? Ed? We all ready to go? I'm Rob Olson, director with Dallas Philosopher's Forum. I want to welcome everyone here. As most of you know, we meet on the second and the fourth Tuesday of each month, ending in May. And then we'll start back up in September. We're getting started on developing our fall schedule. So if you haven't paid already, please do so right after the lecture to our treasurer, Jack Youngkin. Jack, can you raise your hand? It's $5 or $35 for 6 months. If you're a student, it's $2. So if you haven't paid when you came in, then please do so right after the lecture. And also, please make sure that you pay for your bill here at the restaurant as well. We have a website that has a lot of the same information. It's www.philosophersforum.org. So feel free to check us out on the web as well. And now please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode. I'd like to introduce our speaker now. Tonight's presenter is Gerald Schilling, an economics instructor at East Hill College. He got his BBA at the University of Central Oklahoma, an MBA at the University of Dallas, and did postgraduate work in economics at the University of North Texas in Denton. He taught for 2 years. He's a seasoned instructor professor. He taught 2 years at El Centro, 4 years at Cedar Valley, 10 years at Richland, and 21 years at Eastfield. Gerald's topic this evening is, should you really be wearing that Adam Smith tie? And now please join me in welcoming Gerald Schilling.
Jack Youngkin called me about 4 or 5 months ago and asked me to speak on something, and so I thought I'd speak on Adam Smith, because I think he may be a misunderstood person. And maybe I may ask back. I teach at community college, and you have to get a lot of interaction, so maybe I can't like 25 minutes. What do you think the most thing, when you hear of Adam Smith, what do you think of the most?
Invisible wealth of nations.
Invisible hand, wealth of nations.
Anything else? Morality.
Morale? Oh, okay. First book, huh?
Mrs. Smith's son.
There wasn't a Mrs. Smith in your wife, so I guess, yeah. I think he loved the
wife.
How about self-interest?
Enlightened self-interest.
Oh, enlightened self-interest. Well, look at Adam Smith. And where I kind of got this is that when Ronald Reagan was elected, all the businessmen knew they had a strong component of business there. And today, I might try to persuade you that Adam Smith was more free enterprise than he was pro-business. Because they all marched to Washington, D.C. with their Adam Smith ties, saying, well, Adam Smith is here, and we need some deregulations and so forth. So this is kind of a look at Adam Smith. These are a couple of statements. This is one of my favorite writers, Robert Heilberger, the worldly philosopher, said, even today, in the wise disregard of his actual philosophy, Smith is generally regarded as a conservative economist, whereas in fact he was more avowedly hostile to the motives of businessmen than most New Deal economists. Why people don't think of him that way? Marx says what strikes here about all the crudely empirical conceptions of profit derived from the outlook of ordinary capitalists, because ordinary capitalists as far as the deregulation, which totally contradicts the better esoteric understanding of Adam Smith. So in other words, I think sometimes we look at Adam Smith more or less on the surface rather than thinking of Adam Smith with more depth and his other books. Kind of give you a little bit of start. Since when we begin to see the end of the feudal era and merchants began, the question was, what is a just price? So the Catholics looked at it, the scholastics and the schoolmen, looked at it and said, what is a just price? And they had the debates and their argument. And they came up with the idea that a just price is the price of the cost of the labor to produce the product. That is a fair and just price. But you have to remember in those days, merchants weren't held in high regard. And so the physiocrats come along, and they're from France, and Adam Smith does meet some of them when he's in Paris. And basically, they look at all the value that's created from agriculture. And so the labor of the agriculture, the merchant's the lowest in the status, and the agriculture man is at the top. So Adam Smith takes a lot of these things and his ideas as far as that. We'll get into the value theory of labor in a moment. But Adam Smith basically says that there's 4 stages of development. First is the hunter and gatherers. Now, there's no accumulation of wealth, so you don't have to worry about income distribution problems, basically, with the hunters and gatherers, because they can't store what they have and so forth. Most of the items they have are perishable. So, then you go to shepherds. Now you're going to get some differentiation in wealth, because, well, some people are going to keep bigger herds than others. And then you go to the farming community, and that's where the physical place, where they were the farming community. But by the time Adam Smith gets here, he's entered the era of what? Commercialism. So now we are in the era of commercialism. Okay, and this is where Adam Smith comes in, because he defines what the mercantile system is. Mercantilism is an economic nationalism for the purpose of building a wealthy and powerful state. Adam Smith coined the term mercantile system. He described a system of political economy that sought to enrich a country by restraining imports and encouraging exports. This system dominated the Western world economic thought and policies from the 16th to the late 18th century, when the classical economists came along and kind of turned a little bit of that upside down. The goal of these policies was supposedly to achieve a favorable balance of trade that would bring gold and silver into the economy and also maintain domestic employment. In contrast to the agricultural system of the physiocrats, on the laissez-faire of the 19th century and early 20th century economists, the mercantile system served the interests of the merchants and producers, as the British India, East India Company, whose activities were protected and encouraged by the state. So the world that Adam Smith walked into was the age of what? The trading companies that had been granted charters by the government. The craft guilds, which restricted employment, and some towns had certain things like a steel town and a fabric town and so forth, in which if you were going to be a master craftsman, you had to be an apprentice first. And they oftentimes made it very difficult for a young person to become an apprentice and had long apprentice with not much money. So those type of things were restricting people from entering into what you might say, pursuing their own self-interest. Now, I've kind of got one other slide here. The most important economic rationale for mercantilism in the 16th century was the consolidation of the regional power centers of the feudal era by large competitive nation states. So we see the rise of the nation states. Other contributing factors were the establishment of colonies outside Europe, the growth of European commerce and industry relative to agriculture, the increase in the volume and the breadth of trade, and the increase in the use of metallic monetary system, particularly gold and silver. Most of the mercantilist policies were the outgrowth of the relationship between the government and the nation states and their mercantile classes. In exchange for paying levies and taxes to support the armies of the nation states, the mercantile classes induced governments to enact policies that would protect their business interests against foreign competition. So that's what Adam Smith basically was against, is the mercantilist policies in which the businessmen and the government were what? Pretty cozy together, in which they did what? Introduced policies in order to. Now if we go to the craft guilds and so forth like that, they basically were in cahoots with the businessmen in the town, and they were what? They got the protection for paying their taxes and their fees also. And so this is one of the things that Adam Smith was writing about. Let me go back up. Let's look at some of the ideas of the tenets of Adam Smith. First, he was steeped in natural law. Okay? He studied Newton's laws and so forth, and he was steeped in natural laws. And in this time, in Scotland, natural law was extremely important. And that led to the invisible hand, the idea that what? There's certain things in nature, natural things, that will occur. And basically, what he thinks is interfering with the occurrence of this were the mercantilists and the craft guilds and the unions, as far as that's concerned. So, natural law becomes important, and if we look a little bit later to his moral sentiments, you'll see that natural law comes into play there too. Now, the labor theory of value. Now, remember the physiocrats thought that what? The value of a product should be based on the labor put into the product. And Adam Smith carries this on, and of course, Karl Marx carries it along a little bit further.
Marx got it from Adam Smith?
I think he might have.
I think so.
And Adam Smith may have got it from physiocrats. But there's something happening here as Adam Smith moves on with his book, is that labor is not the only input anymore, because now you have what?
It's product.
You have capital going in there. Now, we're also going to have rent, and we'll get into the theory of rent here in a moment, so forth. Because this time, what? The lands aren't owned in common. There's private ownership of land, so what? There's going to be rent paid. And so you're also going to have to, what, pay a profit for the entrepreneur to take the risk. So he will include all those, but as far as some of his works there, labor was considered to be a great extent part of the value. I won't get into to the division of labor right now, but we get into natural price. Adam Smith thought the price of a product would move to a natural price, okay? As opposed to you have a market price and you have a natural price. And my economics class, I said there's an equilibrium price and then there's a market price. And we assume in a competitive market, you might have a market price that is higher than the equilibrium price, but eventually what? The price will adjust to the equilibrium price. And that's somewhat, to some extent, what Adam Smith was calling the natural price. And then, of course, we'll get into the role of self-interest and competition, so forth. Okay, let's talk about self-interest first. These are some quotes by Adam Smith. Every individual necessarily labors to render the annual revenue of the society as great as every man, as long as he does not violate the laws of justice, is left perfectly free to pursue his own interests, his own way, and to bring both his industry and capital into competition with those of any other men. And that is in confrontation with the craft guilds and so forth today. He generally neither intends to promote the public interest. In other words, he's not assuming that the person by producing something is actually what? Promoting the public interest. Nor he knows how much he is promoting the public interest, nor how much he is promoting it by preferring to support the domestic industry. So in other words, he's saying what? Men pursuing their own self-interest inadvertently what? Pursue the interest of society. Not their intentions to, but their interest to society. So that's where self-interest comes into play, and that's basically how I teach in my class. Now there's another side to Adam Smith. Because Adam Smith's first book was really what? Moral philosophy, moral sentiment there. And this is kind of a take I've got this from this professor. And he compares self-interest to the egoist versus the non-egoist. And he would probably classify Adam Smith as the non-egotist. In other words, other than just self, there are others around you. In theory of moral sentiment, contributes to both psychology and ethics, purposes to find the basis of ethical judgment in human psychology. So, in other words, we use this term all the time in economics, that people have certain natural propensities. And that's basically where the natural law that Adam Smith is saying was. That people had certain sympathies and natural propensities to look out for the interests of the others. And he defines one of these first as sympathy, a disposition to experience certain feelings when we see other persons in a certain situation. In other words, we are a distant person, but we are able to feel those feelings. Tendency to want others to feel towards us in a way that harmonizes with our feelings of ourselves, and a disposition to want to be worthy of the approval of others. Mm-hmm. Okay, and from this, Adam Smith kind of, you mentioned what, enlightenment?
Mm-hmm. Self-interest.
And so he compares him to, say, just the egotist view of self-interest as compared to, of course, the non-egotist view. Now, here's competition, that lack of competition, because Adam Smith believed if you're going to drive the price to the natural price, you have to have competition. In other words, some of the things where we talk about the free enterprise system is an ease of entry of competitors in the market, pursuing their own self-interest. And in this particular vein, as he's writing, in any particular branch of trade or manufacturers is always in some respect different from and even opposite to that of the public. To widen the market and to narrow the competition is always in the interest of the dealer. Okay, I've got to give you an example. I worked for Kraft Foods for 6 years before I started teaching. It was my job to go out there and encourage my competitor to expand their business, or was I looking out for Kraft Foods? And do major corporations sometimes want to narrow the business or narrow the market? This would be examples where companies do what? Will merge with other companies to narrow the market. In other words, we're assuming they're operating their own self-interest. By raising the profits above what they naturally would be, by controlling some degree of the market, they will raise the prices above the natural equilibrium price that you have in the standard market. To levy for their own benefit an absurd tax upon the rest of their fellow citizens. So Adam Smith says, by what? By controlling the market and getting the price above the natural price, it has the same impact on raising crops. We might look at it today, and we might argue that what OPEC is unfairly taxing us. By controlling the supply of oil, they get probably what is above a natural price for oil, and therefore what? It's a arbitrary tax, because if you pay more for gasoline, it's no different than you having to pay more taxes to the government. So what he's saying is, by keeping the price above what it would naturally be, they do it for their own benefit. And again, it's an absurd tax on the rest of the fellow citizens. The proposal of any new law or regulation of commerce which comes from this order, he's talking about the merchants, ought to always be listened to with great precaution, and ought never to be adopted without having been long and carefully examined, not only with the most scrupulous and with the most suspicious. Okay, now, I pulled up one the other day and was talking about how Wall Street had taken our rights from us. Now this goes back a while, and this was actually during the Reagan administration, where there was a movement where when you sign a contract with your broker, you're not allowed to sue your broker. You have to go into arbitration. In other words, he would say the merchants want to get these laws passed in order to what? To reduce the freedom of the citizens to go into the courts and sue. And I think in some cases there's contracts where if you have a harassment suit and so forth that you don't have the right to go to courts, you have to go to arbitration. So he was very skeptical of what? The merchants and what he would consider the control of government. Producers whose interests have been so carefully attended to, and among this later class, our merchants and manufacturers have by far been the principal architects in the mercantile regulations which have been taken notice in this chapter. The interest of the manufacturers has been most peculiarly attended to. It cannot be very difficult to determine who has been the contrivers of this whole mercantile system, not consumers. You may believe those interests have been entirely neglected. So he was complaining about what? The close relationship between business and the merchants in passing laws and so forth. So, in other words, again, I point out that he is more free enterprise than what I would say he would be for business. And I tried to differentiate. Now we get to the natural price. Well, the natural price is one for what? We assume the price will automatically go to. So, in a capitalistic or free market economy, if the price of something rises above the natural price, it creates what we call an economic profit. That's above what is needed to produce the profit. Okay. I have a ranch, and I raise cattle. And what's happened to the price of cattle recently is because the supply and the drought has increased, the supply of cattle has gone down, and the price has been driven up. Okay, we know that may just be temporary, because what will happen is once the drought is over, there'll be the more production of cattle that will drive the price down to a more natural price. Because agricultural prices may be the most competitive prices that we have in the economy. We see the price of corn goes up, and then what happens? People produce more corn. So in agriculture, I grew up on a farm, but I knew I couldn't make a living on a farm. Because on the average, a farmer is just going to break even. He's going to earn a normal profit, but he's probably not going to earn an economic profit because it's too easy for what? Competitors to come in and produce the goods. And we may pay a higher price, and it'll drive that. Now, my dad got driven out of farming because what? The price he was producing at was not a competitive price, because when the price dropped, his price was above what we would call the natural price. But Adam Smith says the market, a free market, and there's ease of entry into the marketplace, and people have access to it, the price will tend to gravitate towards the natural price. Now, I'm not going to invest in a company that's going to earn a natural price. I want to invest in Apple. Yeah. Because Apple's going to earn what? An economic profit above a natural price. But he really, Adam Smith really wasn't worried about the producer earning an economic profit. He was more concerned about the consumer. And that's why he believed in the competition. Now, when we talk about rent-seeking, and it says, as soon as the land of any country has become private property, the landlords, like other men, love to reap where they never sowed and demand even from its natural produce. Well, this is kind of thing that you think of at that time, because basically when all these economists said, you know, the land was provided free by nature or God, have looked at, why should someone benefit from it or what? They didn't create the land. So in other words, he's saying that the landlords are reaping rents above their opportunity costs. Now, this is a little bit carried on, because when the manufacturers can limit competition, the price goes above a natural price, and we often call that the economic profit or the economic rent. Apple does it, doesn't it? Now, for today, Apple might have a little bit of a problem, but because the carriers are going to stop subsidizing Apple so much. Okay, which would give them what? Drive up the price of the iPhone. Well, the carriers may think they're what? They have the ability to earn the economic profits. Now, and you're competing with Apple for that what? That economic rent, that above the cost of production. So, in other words, that comes into play because any price above the natural price is going to be what? Presumed to have some type of rent-seeking behavior. Now, if I'm a business person, I want what? Rent-seeking behavior. Okay, I raise cattle, I raise Black Angus cattle. Now, why would I raise Black Angus cattle? Do Black Angus cattle sell for more than the others? So what am I engaged in? I'm engaged in rent-seeking, because y'all think Black Angus beef is better, right? Oh, come on. Okay. So, we're all engaged with this rent-seeking behavior, and Adam Smith, the only way you get rid of the rent is to have a competition and allow the freedom to go into the markets. Now, of course, in Adam Smith's days, we don't have what? We don't have the complexity of technology and so forth we do today, because we know what? In certain businesses, you're probably not going to have a large number of competitors because of the amount of capital investment you have to make in the business. Again, this was in a different time. Okay, kind of the role of government. The government of an exclusive company of merchants is perhaps the worst of all governments in any country whatever. So he's looking at the mercantilists and their ability to what, control the government. So he's saying, what? If the businessmen are running the government, that is the worst kind of government.
Yeah.
I mean, he's seeing the extremes of the mercantilists at that particular period of time. Adam Smith did not apparently see government regulation in favor of the worker or the consumer or the public good as much as he saw the producer's compact with government in the defense of the rich against the poor, the workers, or the consumers. In other words, he's saying what? He's saying what? Most of the compacts with government are what? Against the workers, the consumer, etc. Okay, now on wages. Let's look at some of these, because I'm going to use some of these thoughts that we might be able to take into our current thinking today. No society can be flourishing and happy in which the greater part of the members are poor. It is equity besides that they feed, clothe, and lodge the whole body of the people should have such a share of the produce of their own labor as to themselves tolerably well-fed, clothed, and lodged. That would be what? Some cities have passed what we call the living wage. I think San Francisco has a above the minimum wage and a living wage, so you might argue for that. Our merchants, master manufacturers, complain much about high wages and raising price, and thereby lessening the sale of their goods at both home and abroad. They say nothing concerning the effects of high profits. They are silent in regard to the pernicious effects of their own gains. They complain only of those of other people. And so, there again, you're looking at it. He's looking, I think, in the interest of the wage earners when you look at that particular situation. When the legislator attempts to regulate the difference between the master and their workmen, its counselors are always the masters. When the regulation, therefore, is in favor of the workmen, it is always fair and equitable, but sometimes otherwise in favor of the master. And so when we look at those things, it might give us a little different view of what we've seen of Adam Smith before, because we usually don't get past what? Self-interest, the wealth of nations, and something like that. Education. This is a topic too, because then he felt like we had to have a well-educated population in order to have a growing economy. The education of the common people requires, perhaps in a civilized and commercial society, the attention of the public more than that of people of the same rank and fortune. Said Adam Smith apparently was concerned with what? With some rank and fortune. Of those that were less fortunate in regards to their education. On taxes, because you hear a lot today about flat taxes and so forth like that, it is not very unreasonable that the rich should contribute to the public expense, not only in proportion to their revenues, but something more than that proportion. In other words, i.e. a progressive income tax.
Yeah.
And so there again, I think you're looking at a different Adam Smith than people have looked at. On riches, which Adam Smith was not rich, he was comfortable, he wasn't rich, which the greater part of the rich people, the chief enjoyment of the riches consists of the parade of riches, which in their eye is never so complete as when they appear to possess those decisive marks of opulence which nobody can possess but themselves. This is consistent with Thorsten Veblen and his conspicuous consumption in his writing of the books. Okay, so what should be the end goals of an economic system? We'll look at Adam Smith, and we'll look at Milton Friedman. Consumption is the sole and end purpose of all production, and the interest of the producer ought to be attended to only so far as it may be necessary for the promoting that of the consumer. So he would say anything that is done to what? To benefit the producer should be designed to what? To benefit the consumer. Now, if we compare that with Milton Friedman's comment and his Capitalism and Freedom, there is one and only one social responsibility of business: to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profits, so long as it stays within the rules of the game, which is to say, engages in open and free competition without deception or fraud. So, in other words, I'm assuming that he's saying the process of producing those profits, you benefit the consumer, would be one of the arguments on that. But I just wanted to show you the contrast of Adam Smith's purpose of business and consumption as compared to Milton Friedman.
One more
question. We won't argue that now. But yeah, I mean, the intent is what? You make a profit, but you serve the consumer first. I mean, I'll be honest with you, when I was in Kraft Food, the customer was always right.
Right, Walmart made much more profit than
even Market. Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, in other words, when those two can compete there, but maybe not. Okay, here's another one of my favorite quotes by Adam Smith. I'm one of those. I grew up in rural Oklahoma with a really fundamentalist Baptist background. You know, I'm kind of like the kids, you know, when I found out at school there wasn't a Santa Claus, I went home and asked my mother, what about that Jesus guy? Okay. Because I have a degree of what?
Skepticism.
A degree of skepticism. And if you got a little bit of skepticism, I found that you have to live with some degree of ambiguity. And so that's one of my favorite quotes. So, now, we can enter into a discussion. I throw this out and then I'll let you ask me some questions. Given the special interest influence of lobbyists in Washington and the state capitals today representing the primary interest of the merchants, how would Adam Smith see the world differently than that of the mercantilist era which he...
Not much.
I don't know that he would see it that much. And that's where I'm kind of going to get, should you really be worrying about Adam Smith's time?
Then you should make all political contributions anonymous.
You shouldn't?
You should make all of them anonymous. That way we'd need no special interest.
If it was anonymous to the person that received the contribution.
The candidate would never know where his money was coming
from. But they know where it's coming from.
Right, if they take away that, then it would be a true free market.
What's the finish talk?
That would help.
Yes, and the unions are great contributors.
Oh,
so to say that the unions represent workers, so to say.
I would stay with you, but the union has shrunk to such a small portion of the labor force today that I think it's not as relevant as the business community.
Okay, hold on.
Because the percentage, now, with public service workers, it is a pretty strong, but the unions
hold the majority of the stock now.
No, they don't. Pension funds.
They
do own that, but I mean, like the public service in California, that's a very large one too. No, I'm not denying. But Adam Smith said the same thing about the crack deals as he said about the unions. That in that process, they were restricting people from entering and the markets and so forth. Yeah, I would agree with you. Yeah.
So what do you think he would say about cronyism that we have today?
I think he would say that's the mercantilism. Crony capitalism.
Don't say capitalism. It's cronyism.
Well, crony capitalism.
Whatever.
Cronyism.
Capitalism is free market. Laissez-faire. And now you have to say laissez-faire capitalism. But capitalism means the separation of government from business, the same way the United States separation of state.
Let's finish this talk.
Are you just talking to
Well, you complain about a government. You complain about a government of merchants, which is exactly what socialism is. So once the government takes over the merchant classes, then what you have is when he's against the government of merchants. That's what socialism is.
What does globalization have to? I mean, do we have to be moving away from moving towards more of the supply side economy because of globalization?
Well, I think it is more supply side because you're able to produce more product at a lower price.
Okay, so Jack, and then Jack.
So Gerald, I was kind of interested in knowing if he had any commentary around, he talks about the production is for consumption, but which really drives what? I mean, you got to have consumption for people to go get capital and do the production. But like when you're in a situation sort of like we're in right now, where consumption is not as great as it could be, did he have any ideas about how to stimulate consumption or whose job?
He would leave that to Keynes.
Bob?
What do you think he would say about our system now of financial investments that make money on financial investments and not producing anything?
I didn't find that much because in today's world, finance dominates.
I know.
Much of our industry. And I don't think it did back in Adam Smith's time. So I really didn't find anything.
Adam Smith's kind of.
I didn't find anything in regards to the power of finance because that was.
That's where the money's made today. Nobody produces anything. They just trade paper.
Somebody has to produce it.
Yeah.
He keeps talking about the mercantilists working with the government. Isn't he just talking about fascism?
I don't know if it would go as far.
Well, that's basically what fascism is. When the merchants pay off the government, and the government says, sure, we'll make the laws the way you want. And, I mean, the little guy gets screwed. I mean, it's been that way forever.
Well, I mean, that's what they would say whenever we had the takeover of GM and so forth. I mean, the bailouts, that was fascism because what's the government and the businesses together. So.
Yeah, the government just made health insurance financing mandatory. And, that's, again, a government of merchants. Mm-hmm. If health insurance is mandatory, then, that particular merchant class, that financing people, are now...
They just sit back and watch the money roll in.
You have a question, Ray?
Yeah, I mean, it's when do we see the invisible hand is the question. We haven't seen the invisible hand yet of Adam Smith when we have things like what's going on right now where the financiers are taking over the healthcare system.
The government, as you have fewer companies and less competition, the invisible hand becomes less efficient.
Right, so now that we have a mandate, few companies that run healthcare.
Another thing is Jack and I, and this deals with healthcare, and I don't have to deal with this issue that Jack and I have talked about in it. You know, we're in a society where we're operating with asymmetrical information. That's where I see a lot of income distribution going about, because you've got the poor and they don't have adequate information. So we're operating over here with a man, I like to use in my class, going in to buy a car. Some people just go in to buy a car. Why? And what? They have less information than the person selling. Now, I don't know that I'll ever have enough, as much information as the seller has. But I know if I'm going to get a good deal, I'm going to have to what? I'm going to have to get that information. And what's happening, I think, in a lot of the world, whether it's a mortgage loan, insurance and so forth, the complexity of it has put people where they have what? They're having adverse information buying there.
Huh?
What do you think he would say about our system of corporatism? There were no corporations in his day. He's talking about individual entrepreneurs and maybe partnerships. But we invented corporations and we made them people.
I think he would only say it up to the extent of what you saw with the trading companies, the entities like that. If corporations behaved like the merchants did, you'd probably have the same feeling. I think that's what I kind of addressed.
So he would be against our system of corporatism.
Now, I don't know if he would be against corporatism. He would be against the influence that corporatism had. I don't know.
Because corporatism, as Mussolini defined it, as fascist.
Basically, yeah. To play back here in blue?
Yeah.
I began to be boggled by the system because at this time people lived off the land, and the structure of the tax and rents that were received was a very small percentage of human population. If you look at the percentage of the government's taxes today. On the individual people, which we begin to see in things like someone's secretary pays more in taxes than they do, making millions of dollars a year, we begin to get a perspective. And I think you would be overwhelmed, as I am, with the vast amounts happening, that where it gets accumulated, well, such as the exchange-traded funds, which are options on options. This is mind-boggling, because any changes just double the losses in profits.
It's not
real production.
I think that might be one of the criticisms against Adam Smith's theory as far as some of the application today, because he was operating in a world where the businesses were a lot smaller, you don't have the corporations. You were operating also where, you know, if you're going to, like Jerry Jones with the Cowboys said, in other words, corporations today have to invest so much money in fixed assets that reduces the flexibility of moving, say, from one industry to another. And I think he felt like at the time, because there wasn't such a high level of fixed investments, that there would be more flexibility. But, you know, we asked people to build power plants that are going to be good for 25 years.
Yes.
And so that reduces some of the flexibility in there, where I think, you know, he, in his writings, I think he felt like that the resources, there was more fluid and flexible movement in the economy.
Well, they were. And I think Adam Smith is wonderful. Understanding the very basics, because in any pyramid system, which is what we're living in, there has to be a base. And the base is Adam Smith. And everything else is derivative.
But another thing I kind of like to address, because I read an article the other day about this, and I teach at Eastfield College, which we have a lot of lower socioeconomic students that come there. And a lot of them come to school not prepared to work for the jobs in the future. And you know, this was dealing with income distribution. We're getting to the point that those with the higher skills are adding much more value added, you might say. And so you're seeing those people migrate to the higher level job skills. And so, you know, as far as the flexibility of where our students are going to find jobs and good pay, you know, it's going to be a lot less than probably has been.
This gentleman in the back.
If I hadn't been to grow up in Italy or France, would you have come up with the same ideas?
I don't even hazard to guess, sir. I don't know.
I mean, I would just, yeah. You know.
Well, let me address that.
The institutions in which you grew up in at that period of time produced his thought patterns, or, you know, if he was an Italian, would he have come up with the same thing?
But Scotland at the time was in the Enlightenment age.
That's right.
And he happened to be at the right place at the right time. He happened to have some fantastic professors, Hutchison, and then David Hume was his good friend.
Yep.
So he was around. That era in Scotland was the real intellectual era. And he probably may not have come up with those ideas had he been born someplace else.
Yep.
That was a good, if you wanted to be an intellectual, that was a good place to be at that time.
Right.
Questions? How would Adams...
This first. I mean,
I've been raising my hand.
I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead.
How does Adam Smith's theory apply to our current system where corporations are really no longer indigenous in the sense, for example, Apple? You can say Apple's workforce isn't really all American. In fact, 80% of you call contracting labor as your labor force. They're really international, mostly foreign. So how would that theory apply to corporations that are no longer loyal, to a certain extent, to all the individual nations that they belong to?
Can I give you kind of a comment in regard to the way I deal with my students? My father got out of World War II, and many men like him got out of World War II. They went to work for a corporation, and they had a job the rest of their life, and they had a nice pension. When they retired, they got good benefits. I often call it corporate socialism. We'll take care of you. There was a degree of sympathy there, because they liked to be. When I went to work for Kraft Foods, it was that same way. But Kraft Foods not that way anymore, because it's a global corporation. And I don't know how to address this issue, so I don't have all the answers, I'll tell you. Because it's almost, we've got a labor force as, how would we put it, commodities. Labor has become more of a
commodity.
And one thing I drilled to my students, I said, you know, and when I talk about this, you know, I said, you know, pension plans are disappearing. How would I put it? I said, you know, I think George W. Bush, when he wanted to switch the Social Security to a private plan, said we want to live in the ownership society. The way I kind of address it this way, you're on your own. I mean, I hate to say it, but what? You're on your own. Because corporations will come in and what? You're gone.
I appreciate what you're sharing here. And I'd like to get a little global perspective to it, because I'm sensing we're trying to apply Adam Smith directly to our time. Let me give an example. We've been to India 4 times. I've been invited to teach at universities there. And I discovered a very interesting item. Colonialism, you know, and the mercantile and the East India Corporation, not a company, but a corporation. They hated the British, the French, the Spanish, Portuguese, but I was amazed who they appreciated, and it was the Germans, because in the 1830s, they brought education, translation, and vocational and agricultural knowledge. I was amazed. Now, I think we've got to appreciate today how the corporation is acting exploitative. For instance, in India, Bhopal, is hated. Enron is hated because they tried to exploit. Now, is it fair to try to apply Adam Smith to today's economy?
No.
No, I don't think so. I'm not saying, I'm trying to present the idea, but like I was saying, you know, as far as the marketplace and the natural price, big corporations have economies of scale that what smaller people can't compete with. And so, and I'm saying that, you know, maybe those companies are the mercantilists of today. Because they go into countries and get laws passed on their behalf and so forth. So I think we can take that from that. Can the world work like Adam Smith, back in, like in Adam Smith's time? I don't think so.
See, the British and Europe operate from a power position. They were the wealthy. They controlled resources and they exploited it. Well, some of that's happening today. And Adam Smith has some insights, but I don't think it can be applied directly to our
government. And sometimes I have a question because Apple got in a little bit of trouble because paying low wages in those countries. And you could argue, well, at least they're creating jobs.
Pardon?
At least they're creating jobs that people wouldn't have had.
Yeah.
So I don't have the answer to all those things.
Any other questions? Okay, let's, oh yes, Ed.
I'd like to raise a question that's fundamental, not only to Adam Smith, but to most economics since. That's the concept of equilibrium. Most of economics is full of curves to describe projected equilibrium prices in certain situations. And you'll get things like increasing returns to scale, so on. But if you think about equilibrium from a science and engineering point of view, you also have to think about transience. Equilibrium takes time to be arrived at. And in terms of the analysis of an economic system, actually what we have looked at is a series of snapshots of past behaviors after some approximation of equilibrium had happened. When you don't get equilibrium in the short run, you have booms and busts and all kinds of chaos that people have trouble adapting to. And I don't just mean the people who are living through it, I mean the people who are charged with thinking about it, the economists and government planners and political forces. And it seems to me that in the modern world, we have integrated our society and our communication and our ability to bring things to market to such an extent that equilibrium is very hard to glimpse. The market is flooded at one time, and hula-hoops are out of fashion the next year. And equilibrium doesn't have much to do with that.
You just need a guy that's good in supply side management. Just need a guy that's good knows about supply side management. I don't know because the market's changed so rapidly these days. You know, because the information and the technology. It's kind of like why Warren Buffett won't invest in high tech companies. He said, I don't understand. Like you're saying right there. I don't understand what the equilibrium is. You know, I'm not going to invest in Facebook. I don't understand the model. And you know the technology can wipe a company out almost overnight. And so that's why you have the young guys that are willing to take the risk in those businesses like this. But I would agree with you, but the idea I guess in economics is I tell my students the market may never achieve equilibrium, it's searching equilibrium.
Right.
And it's just like he was talking about, the market's always gyrating towards the natural price. And so that's kind of where I see that.
Any other questions? Let's give a round of applause for Joe. Let's hear if in 2 weeks, make sure you pay Jack Youngkin, our treasurer, if you haven't already.
Sure. Would it be okay if we posted your presentation on our website?
Yeah.
So if you can just email it to me.
Well, yeah,
I
like
to
make this kind of money. Yeah.
Well, just email it to me.
That was very enlightening.
I put this in the batteries. You just put some in there?
They're not fresh. They had some juice on them. When that green light starts flashing, that definitely means we need to put batteries on.
Yeah.
Was it fading out on you?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so I'm not going to get some juice on there.
We have a lot of great teachers.